Good morning, I'm Lawrence K. Jackson. It's Monday, January 26th. Advocates worry a recent decision puts transgendered youth at risk. More on that next, but first, the headlines. A number of demonstrations against ICE were held around the county and across the country on Friday. One of the local protests was held in Mira Mesa, next to a Homewood Suites hotel. It's part of the Hilton Network. The protesters here and elsewhere are calling on Hilton to stop hosting ICE agents at their properties across the nation. Protest leader Margaret Dolly Samuley says if they don't, they're going to face economic consequences.
Hilton is going to lose business and a lot of reputation if they continue to house ICE and make not just collaborate, but make money off this totally un-American abuse.
The protests were in solidarity with one in Minnesota, where thousands of people turned out in bitter cold temperatures to call on their fellow Americans to resist ICE in peaceful, legal ways. The city of San Diego is offering financial help to cover its new trash and recycling fees. To qualify, you need to own a home and it needs to be your primary residence. After that, at least one person in your household needs to be enrolled in a program already providing assistance like Medi-Cal or CalFresh. You also need to have a household income at or below 60% of California's median income. If approved, the city will pick up the tab for your yearly trash and recycling fees. You can go to maacproject.org for more. There is an upcoming county budget workshop tomorrow. Time is also being set aside for you to give input on what you feel should be prioritized in the upcoming budget. The workshop starts at 3 p.m. and the community input portion will begin at 5. Both are being held at the County Administration Center on Pacific Highway. This is for the county's 2026-27 budget that takes effect on July 1st. From KPBS, you're listening to San Diego News Now. Stay with me for more of the local news you need.
This season on Everybody's Doing It with Miss Lolly, I'm going to classes, workshops, and private venues designed to enrich and broaden our sexual horizons, and I'm taking you with me. I meet with an erotic mindfulness coach, get a pelvic floor exam, talk with new moms, and even put on my dancing shoes and take a beginning burlesque class, and much more. Find season 2 of Everybody's Doing It with Miss Lolly wherever you get your podcasts, and come join me in my search for fun and sexy adventures that are available to you.
Grady Children's Hospital says it will stop providing gender-affirming care. They say threats of federal cuts could impact hospital funding. Health reporter Heidi DeMarco says advocates are worried the decision puts transgendered youth at risk.
Grady Children's Hospital says it will no longer provide medical interventions for transgender youth, including prescriptions and procedures starting February 6. Counseling, mental health support, and care coordination will continue. In a statement, the hospital says the decision is in response to federal actions that could impact its Medicaid and Medicare funding.
There are a lot of youth and their families who were already in the process of receiving this care from Rady's.
David Vance manages advocacy for the San Diego LGBT Community Center,
who are now going to have to very likely stop accessing that care.
Kaiser pediatrician John Dani DeJour says abrupt interruptions can increase health risks.
It disrupts ongoing medical relationships, it increases the mental health risk, it deepens the inequities in healthcare systems, and it fractures the continuity of care like you're talking.
She says Kaiser is already seeing patients from Rady, but switching providers isn't an option for many families. Heidi DeMarco, KPBS News.
Most of San Diego's military community is composed of sailors and Marines. Military reporter Andrew Dyer takes us to Camp Pendleton, where a small Army unit is doing big things for animals.
Most people don't realize there are a lot of veterinarians in the Army.
Army veterinarian Lieutenant Colonel Craig Calkins is the commander of the clinic. This small unit of soldiers is opening a brand new, state-of-the-art veterinary treatment facility.
So that's all the rooms, the floor.
Staff Sergeant Timogen Benton says their main mission is to care for military dogs, but most of their patients are service members' pets, and it's quite a benefit.
Our price is significantly cheaper than out in town, where if you came into us and you got all the vaccines, it'd be like $150, $160. Out in town, you're looking to pay $400 or $500 for the same exact vaccines.
The new clinic has the latest technology and all the capabilities of a veterinary hospital, including surgery. Andrew Dyer, KPBS News.
Oceanside is getting tough on reckless e-bike riders after a surge of complaints from residents. North County reporter Alexander Wen says the city is considering a new rule that would let police seize e-bikes from offenders.
Popping wheelies and darting in and out of traffic, these are some of the dangerous behaviors that Oceanside Police Captain Scott Garrett says contributed to the deluge of complaints from residents.
We haven't seen much of a decrease in our calls for service and community complaints.
He says since 2021, there has been a tenfold increase in complaints, from less than 100 in 2021 to nearly 1,000 last year. Garrett says handling these complaints is a burden on police resources and time, and the current regulations don't seem to be working. So the police department went back to the drawing board.
We decided that utilizing temporary seizure of e-bikes would provide a sufficient and immediate deterrent for a lot of the youth.
Riders can get their e-bikes back once they've completed a safety course. The council is expected to give final approval to the rule Wednesday. Then enforcement would begin 30 days later. Alexander Nguyen, KPBS News.
As we move further into the 21st century, remnants of the old frontier of the American West are getting harder and harder to find. But there's a place in East County where you can immerse yourself in that time and place. Reporter John Carroll takes us there in January's Museum of Month.
You could almost miss it in the shadow of El Cajon's Civic Center, a museum that's a time capsule into the old American West.
It gives younger generations who weren't exposed to that part of history a little influence to preserve the Western heritage of this country.
John Stauffer is talking about the Olaf Wighorst Museum and Western Heritage Center. He's the chairman of the museum's board.
The interesting thing about the United States of America, we have a rather recent frontier which has gone by the wayside over the last 100 years because the frontier sort of phased itself out.
But the frontier, through the eyes of Olaf Wighorst, is very much alive here. It comes to life through Wighorst's paintings.
Olaf Wighorst loved horses.
Jim Daniels founded the Olaf Wighorst Museum in 1999 in an old Goodwill store. Now, its walls are covered with Wighorst's art.
The big one in the center is the original oil.
Wighorst was born just about as far away from the Western U.S. as you can get, a boy from Denmark that made his way on an ocean liner to the United States.
When the ship docked, he jumped ship and got off in New York. A teenager, couple dollars in his pocket, didn't speak English, didn't know anybody.
Wighorst ended up in the U.S. Cavalry. In those days, if you stayed in 3 years, you automatically became a U.S. citizen. After that, he worked as a cowboy in Texas and eventually made his way west, ending up in El Cajon in 1945. There, he honed his skills as an artist, specializing in the American West, his love of horses shining through most of his works.
Sunshine and shadow.
His paintings appeared in a couple of John Wayne movies, and so did he, with a couple of bit parts in films like the 1967 Paramount Pictures movie El Dorado. Once again, John Stauffer.
Since Olaf Wighorst spent half his life in El Cajon, this is a perfect place for the museum to be. And being that the museum is located in the center of town, it is kind of an ideal, I would say, jewel of what there is to see in El Cajon.
Something that really makes this museum stand out is the house Wighorst and his wife lived in. It was moved years ago to the museum grounds.
We didn't have to change much inside the house. They had to do some code issues for safety, But the house is the way it was. It's the way they lived.
You enter the house through the garage, through the kitchen, and finally to the living room. And there on the north side, a large window that brings in indirect, diffused sunlight, perfect for painting. It became Wighorst's studio. On the wall under the window, something unintentional and very special.
So you can see little flecks of paint on the wall where he would flick his brush.
Wighorst didn't just appear in a couple of John Wayne movies. The two were good friends. Stauffer says Wayne was a frequent visitor, and he says they liked to drink whiskey together. Between the house and the museum, a perfect place to pause and think about the western part of this country, surrounded by plants that are native to the region.
I originally started as a volunteer with a garden.
Mike Bostwick is now the curator of this botanical garden, and he has the kind of experience you want in that role. He retired as curator of horticulture at the San Diego Zoo. He says this garden had about 650 plant species in the ground when he took over. It now has about 1,000.
It really shows the botanical world that we actually live in. It's pretty spectacular.
From the house where you can see how Olaf Wighorst lived, to the beautiful botanical garden with its southwest desert vibe, to the museum itself, full of the works produced by a man now considered to be among the finest Western artists ever. The Olaf Wighorst Museum is worth a trip to El Cajon to take a journey into the history of the American West. John Carroll, KPBS News.
All right, SDNN listeners, we are back with another installment of the Pod Behind the Package. Each week, I sit down with a reporter, anchor, or a video journalist for a behind-the-scenes chat around a standout piece of journalism that they did. This week, Corey Suzuki brings us a hefty three-part series focusing around a massive $10 billion data center that's moving forward in the Imperial Valley. Corey Suzuki is here with us. What's up, man?
Hey, Lawrence.
Thank you for making time. This is a lot. This is a hefty story that we are tackling. Can you talk to me how you even got alerted about this?
I have to say, I found out about this data center project like a lot of folks who live in Imperial County did. This was close to the end of November when the city of Imperial, city officials in the city of Imperial, which is one of the smaller cities in the center of the county, put out some information about the data center. They did a little sort of press release, an online announcement on social media and on their website. And in it, they said that this project was moving forward, that it was very large, and that it was close to the final stages of approval through the county's planning process because this data center was planned for unincorporated land in Imperial County. And I think, like a lot of people, I started to have some questions about where exactly the project was, how long this had been in development, what kind of the plans were when it came to the potential environmental impacts of data centers, which, as we are seeing kind of across the country, are becoming a bigger and bigger conversation. So it was just a lot of questions at that point. I think I was in the same place as a lot of people who live in Imperial County.
Those in support of data centers would argue they are needed for us to progress into a more modern digital world. Those in opposition list reasons like community disruption, an eyesore, environmental impacts like needing hundreds of thousands of gallons of water per day. When you speak with people in general around data centers, both developers, non-developers, community members, talk to me about their pros and cons for those of who are for or against it.
Let's start with the pros. Mm-hmm. So Sebastian Rucci and his supporters are pitching the data center as something that would be an economic boost for the county. Imperial County, one of the poorer regions in California. It's a majority Latino county. It's very heavily agricultural. It's a rural place. And the developers say that this project would bring tax revenue for the county government, that it would create local demand for the wealth of renewable energy that the valley produces, that it would create a burst of construction work in a region where jobs are pretty hard to come by. Imperial County has historically had among the highest rates of unemployment in California. So those are all reasons why the developers and some of the local officials who support them are sort of saying that this data center could really be an economic boon for the region. Now, I think that what critics of the project see is a real lack of clarity when it comes to how the project will affect the environment. the people that I've talked to and from the concerns that I've heard in public meetings, there is a really big focus on these worries that the project will strain the Imperial Valley's power grid and water supply and will not bring very many benefits for the people who live here. And, you know, number one, although Imperial County does produce all of this renewable energy, there are still a lot of questions nationally and across California about how data centers really affect power grids. You know, what it means for a power user that of that scale to be added to the grid, whether that means that people who are paying for electricity will be paying for infrastructure upgrades. And then secondly, when it comes to water, that is a worry, too. Imperial County also has these longstanding claims to the Colorado River. That's where all of the region's water comes from. And, two, most of the water that comes to the valley goes to agriculture. Just, I mean, a vast majority. And a much smaller amount goes to residents. And access to clean water can sometimes, and the price of clean water can sometimes depend a lot on where you live in the Imperial Valley and what kind of local municipal treatment you have access to. Now, I should say again, just really quick, the project's developers have pledged to take these steps to especially use reclaimed water, have said they plan to recycle large amounts of municipal wastewater from two of the neighboring cities, that they plan to pay for the infrastructure upgrades to get that water, and that they plan to pay for upgrades that will recycle much more water than the data center actually needs, and that they would release the remainder of that water that's left over into the Salton Sea. And so that it could potentially provide some relief to the sea, which is drying up. So there are just still a lot of unanswered questions, a lot of open questions about the project and about how exactly it will land. And in a large part, the lack of answers is in some ways due to the fact that there has not been a formal environmental analysis.
Corey Suzuki here with us on SDNN. Corey, my last question for you. Outside of clever writing and a calm pace to your work, you've also gotten attached to your camera, Corey. We've used one of your photos for our episode artwork. We want to thank you for that. Here's your official art credit for that. Can you tell our audience more about the artwork that you took for this episode?
The response to this proposal, the response to people finding out about this project in November has been very mixed. And there has been a lot of resistance to the data center as a whole. And there have been sort of throughout December and in early January, a lot of people attending county meetings, since the county is the agency that's overseeing and working with the developer on this project, there have been a lot of people attending these meetings and protesting. And so that's the image that you see on the podcast artwork, which is people, just, you know, neighbors, Imperial County residents, there to voice their opposition to the project, to raise questions, and to ask about the process. I think there are a lot of people who are still trying to understand this process and how exactly a project of this scale might be able to avoid going through an environmental review. So that's what you see here is people attending a county meeting, holding signs in protest.
Corey Suzuki with us on Pod Behind the Package. Thank you for your time, Corey. That's it for the podcast today. As always, you can find more San Diego news online at kpbs.org. Thanks for listening and subscribing. By doing so, you're supporting public media, and I really thank you for that. Have a great day.